This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank. Focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The dollar amounts you wind up talking about in the world of high finance kind of make it seem like funny money. Who can really relate to a $40 billion merger anyway, or a $10 billion loan? Maybe not you and maybe not me, but I can tell you who can. Bankers, the folks who wind up lending the money and sometimes get stuck holding the bag. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, representing America's public transportation industry, delivering 10 billion riders annually, and working for an energy-independent America. PublicTransportation.org. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's great to have you with us on this Wednesday. Today is July the 25th. The deal of most concern to Wall Street at the moment is the one taking Daimler Chrysler private. J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs are the lead bankers on the deal with Cerberus Capital Management. We learned today the banks and their counterparts aren't going to be able to syndicate or sell off the loans they've arranged for that deal, $10 billion worth, which, no matter who you are, is a big chunk of money. It's also symptomatic of what some are calling a credit squeeze. Since debt is what makes the business world go around, we figured it might be time to find out whether that's true or not. So we got Mike Hatley into the studio. He's the president of Westgate Horizons Advisors. That's a company that buys some of those loans from the big Wall Street banks. Mike, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Let's take the news of the day that I was just talking about, the Chrysler thing, and then we roll in subprimes, we roll in private equity borrowing a whole bunch of money. And I'm going to ball it all up into one question, which is there a problem in the credit market today?
Yes, there definitely is a problem in the credit market today. There's a definite supply overhang.
What does that mean, supply overhang? It's just money, right?
It's definitely money, but there are all of these loans that banks have underwritten, meaning that they are on the hook to make these loans. They want to sell these loans because they don't want to hold as much risk as they agreed to underwrite.
Mm-hmm.
And they have about $200+ billion of loans to sell. And buyers like us are saying, well, you know, we're kind of full right now. We don't really want to have a whole lot more exposure.
Well, when that happens, what do these banks do? Do they just sit there and just carry this debt and carry this debt?
That's exactly what's happening right now. Case in point is the Chrysler deal at this point. There's two separate loans for Chrysler. There's one for the car company Chrysler, and there's one for the finance company, Chrysler Financial. They were attempting to sell to investors $10 billion worth of loans to Chrysler, the car company, and another $8 billion worth of loans to the finance company. They came to the market today and said, you know what, we're not going to try and sell those loans anymore, the $10 billion to the car company. We're just going to hold them on our books, and we will come back some point in the future and try to sell those loans.
Reconcile these two things for me, though. We are hearing from you and from other people that there are problems in the credit market. And yet, default rates are low. Deals are still getting done. Clearly, people believe there is money to be made lending money. So which is it? What's going on?
Well, defaults are definitely at all-time historic lows right now, but there's still a large supply of loans that the banks have underwritten and have agreed to make that they need to find buyers for. The buyers in the market are holding back right now, and it's going to take a while before those loans make it through the market.
Your group, your company, is one of those buyers of loans, right?
That's right.
So what is your thought process now as you look at these banks holding on to huge amounts of debt when you decide whether to take it off their hands or not?
Well, that's a very good question, and we've been very, very cautious lately in terms of agreeing to buy new loans. And that's largely because the loans that we bought 3 weeks ago, there's a secondary market where these loans trade.
You then sell them off, right? That's the secondary market?
Well, we may sell them off, or other people may sell them off, or we can buy more in the secondary market. Mm-hmm. And the loans that we paid 100 cents on the dollar for on 3 weeks ago are trading at 97 cents on the dollar today. And when you see that kind of a movement, it makes you think, well, why should I buy another new loan right now when it's just going to trade off in the secondary market?
And 3 cents on the dollar when you're talking about a $100 million loan is a whole lot of money.
$3 million. It's real money.
6 months from now, if we call you up and we say, hey, Mike, what's going on in the credit market? Will we either point to this summer as the beginning of something bad, or will it just be a flash in the pan and 6 months from now you guys will be back to normal?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure that we'll be back to normal in 6 months, honestly. I think it could take longer to play out. The one positive fact is the economy overall is still doing pretty well. I mean, we certainly read about the housing sector as being soft, but this is a technical supply-demand imbalance, and it will work itself out, but it may not be 6 months. It may take a year to work itself out.
Mike Hatley is the president of Westgate Horizons Advisors here in Los Angeles. Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
After their drubbing yesterday, investors put all thoughts of subprimes and credit squeezes out of their minds. Today, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. When the Bush administration's domestic surveillance program was revealed a couple of years ago, there was a good deal of speculation about whether or not phone companies were being paid by the government for their customer records. Nothing was ever confirmed on that one way or the other, but there is a twist on the story today. The FBI has asked Congress for money to pay telecommunications companies to store customer data, just in case the agents decide they need it. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports now from Washington.
The FBI has requested $5.3 million to pay telephone and internet companies to store Americans' email and phone records in a massive new database it calls the Telecommunications Data Collection Center.
The relationship over the last few years between the telephone companies and the government has become way too cozy. We've got too much information being disclosed with too little accountability.
Mark Rottenberg is executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, a privacy watchdog group in Washington.
It's like saying to a company, we want a shadow database that can be accessible by the government. That's not public information.
Rottenberg sees possibilities for abuse and the temptation to mine that data to find new terrorism suspects. But John Miller at the FBI sees an invaluable crime-fighting tool.
All you have to do is look back in the 9/11 case, where the hijackers were on the ground, in some cases up to 2 years before the plot was launched, and say, wouldn't it have been valuable had that plot been uncovered to identify the other hijackers by figuring out who had been in touch with whom?
Miller says the FBI would use information in the proposed telecommunications data center the same way it handles business records in thousands of investigations every day. That data would still belong to the telecom providers, and the FBI would still need to get a subpoena or write a national security letter before it could get at the records. The only difference, according to Miller, is that using the proposed database, companies could provide the FBI with data in minutes, instead of spending weeks digging through old files. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
True confessions time now. Nothing to do with the FBI. It's something else. How many of you vote? Not in presidential or even municipal elections. We're talking here about corporate elections. You get those proxy ballots in the mail every now and then. Chances are they go right into the trash can, but they are a much bigger deal for institutional investors. Today, the Securities and Exchange Commission considered new rules that would give shareholders more influence over a company's board of directors. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has that story.
As it stands, only those already serving on a company's board can nominate directors to lead the company. Today, the SEC decided to consider two proposals. One would reaffirm the status quo. The other would permit shareholders who meet certain requirements to propose changes that would allow them to nominate their own directors.
I would call it corporate campaign finance reform.
That's Les Greenberg with the Committee of Concerned Shareholders. He views the ability of investors to nominate candidates for the board as an important check and balance on executive performance.
If a director did something wrong or wasn't doing something right, he should be accountable to the shareholders. If the shareholders cannot nominate their own candidates, then there's no accountability.
Business groups argue that giving shareholders more power to challenge the directors would be expensive and an unnecessary burden. David Hirschman is senior vice president with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
We don't believe that additional rights for shareholders in this area are needed because we believe they will be abused by special interests who really just want to use them as leverage to advance narrow agendas and not advance the broader shareholder interests.
The proposal to exclude shareholder nominations and the proposal to allow changes that could result in shareholder nominations are now both open to comment. The public has 60 days to weigh in. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Some estimates say nearly 100 million Americans are obese. And although it's not contagious, the New England Journal of Medicine reports today obesity is spreading through social networks from spouse to spouse, sibling to sibling, and friend to friend. From WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch has more.
One of the lead authors of the study is Nicholas Christakis from Harvard.
This result is not about birds of a feather flocking together.
Christakis says obesity spreads. If your close friend becomes obese, you are then almost 60% more likely to become obese, too.
People around you gain weight, your attitudes as to what constitutes an acceptable body size changes, and you might then follow suit and emulate that body size.
The surprising discovery helps explain the costly epidemic. In 2004, medical expenses and lost worker productivity set the U.S. back $93 billion. Eric Finkelstein helped the government come up with that figure. He's a health economist at RTI International. Despite the hefty price tag, Finkelstein says programs to get people to lose weight cost more than they're worth.
My uncle is a very rich, very intelligent attorney who happens to be very obese, and it's just not obvious to me why we would want to spend our hard-earned tax dollars to get my uncle to weigh less than he currently does.
But now this new research gives the healthcare industry a better understanding of obesity and maybe how to fight its spread, as in collectively, not individually. Harvard's Christakis says spending $1,000 to help somebody lose 20 pounds might pay off if the benefit spreads from friend to friend.
So the $1,000 we have spent, instead of costing $50 per pound lost in the population, it actually only costs $5 per pound loss.
Making such efforts penny-wise, pound-wise, after all. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
Along with all the rest of the contenders, Democratic presidential hopeful Barack Obama has been hitting the campaign trail pretty hard lately. Last week, he was laying out his plans to fight poverty. There was that YouTube debate on Monday night. Yesterday, he launched a big radio ad buy in South Carolina, a state where half of likely primary voters will be black. Commentator Marcellus Andrews says Obama and others are changing the racial rules of the game.
Black leaders today are not preachers or protesters. No, people like Senator Barack Obama, Mayor Adrian Fenty of Washington, D.C., and Robert Johnson, former CEO of Black Entertainment Television, are leading a quiet revolution of rising expectations that is shaking up all of America, not least Black America. The press is all over stories about how these guys aren't black enough, are sellouts to white people, or have sold their own for a bit of fame and fortune. The truth is, where some see sellouts, far more see harbingers of a future full of power and prosperity. Black people with talent and vision, discipline and toughness will go far in America, despite America. Obama has raised $56 million for his presidential run from 250,000 Americans of all colors by speaking in one voice, a black voice, about what our country could be. Mayor Fenty takes a lot of heat for shaking up the corrupt political culture of a black city caught in the maelstrom of economic change. The road from poverty to prosperity for black people means we have to dump our bad habit of thinking that the only good government for black people is black-only government. Robert Johnson's case is the most shocking of all because he had the nerve to grow rich selling programming to black people while being, heaven forbid, a Republican. When Johnson sold his company to Viacom, somebody said he was selling a precious black asset. Please, the man was selling his stuff, not our stuff. Millions of young black folks are learning the Obama lesson. Work hard, be right, be prepared, and seize the moment when your time comes.
Marcellus Andrews teaches economics at the City University of New York. Send us your thoughts when you get a minute. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, a new brand of hip shoes that gives back when you buy.
It appealed to me before I even knew that there was a cause behind it, just because it's an easy sell in Southern California.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks dipped over those worries about big money financing we mentioned earlier, but then there was a bit of a lift from strong Boeing sales. The Dow Industrials rose 68 points, 0.5% to 13,785. The NASDAQ edged up 8 points, 0.3% to 2,648. The S&P 500 climbed 7 points, 0.5%, 1,518 at the close there. Investors got queasy after underwriters couldn't find financing for some big buyout deals. Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase also both shaved off more than 0.1%. As we mentioned, Boeing gave the market a little altitude. Its stock rose more than 3% on strong earnings, and Amazon stock soared 24% today on its standout performance announced yesterday after the closing bell. Bonds were flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note virtually unchanged at 4.9%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders and new home sales for June. The House Veterans Affairs Subcommittee on Health holds a hearing on exposure to chemical agents during the Gulf War. And it's the anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was signed into law on July 26, 1990. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We learned today U.S. economic growth is officially modest. That's the word the Federal Reserve used in its regional survey of the economy, known as the Beige Book for the color of its cover. Among some of the other things the Fed said, it noted household credit quality deteriorated a bit, in part because we're carrying ever higher balances on our credit cards. Today, General Electric introduced a credit card that capitalizes on that love of plastic and combines it with a concern for the environment. Ashley Milne-Tite has more.
Say you spot an irresistible summer dress. If you buy it with the new GE credit card, GE will put 1% of the purchase price towards buying carbon offsets. Offsets help to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So the more you buy, the more money you can put towards cutting pollution. Tom Gentile is Chief Marketing Officer with GE Money.
A typical individual has a carbon output of 10 tons per year. And if you spend $750 per month on our card, you would generate enough rewards to fund carbon offsets, which could completely neutralize those 10 tons.
Critics sneer that this program's a bit rich coming from GE, a big polluter itself, but Julia Bovey of the Natural Resources Defense Council says it will have a positive impact.
Steps we can take in the right direction help to solve the problem, but I think the key is that they help to generate the political will to pursue real solutions.
Matt Arnold of consulting firm Sustainable Finance agrees. He says plenty of other U.S. banks have similar programs in the works. He sees a time when green credit cards like this will offer more than carbon offsets.
So imagine if you could also buy compact fluorescent light bulbs or energy efficient appliances, that you would actually have a series of product choices that you could cash your credits in towards and maybe get a discount on.
Arnold says industrial companies like GE will always generate pollution, and Americans will remain rampant consumers. But he says, why not let them help the environment while they're spending? In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Much as consumers like to spend, companies do too, on boring stuff like capital investments and debt servicing, and on stuff they like to crow about, things like charitable spending. Companies don't often make charity the centerpiece of their business plans, but this weekend, a Southern California shoe company will be holding house parties across the country, where for every pair of shoes a customer buys, the company will give a pair away. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk, Brett Bruhn reports.
2 years ago, Blake McCoskey traveled to Argentina to learn how to play polo. After long days on the fields there, he saw players slipping on what they call alpargatas. They're basic shoes with canvas tops and rope soles. Cheap, but not cheap enough, McCoskey discovered.
The last week of my trip, I actually was doing volunteer work in Los Pelotones, and I saw lots of children who did not have shoes, and I saw the negative health effects of that. They had blisters, and there were cuts, and they were swollen.
When McCoskey returned to Venice, California, he couldn't shake the image of the shoeless kids. He developed his own line of alpargata with rubber soles. He calls them Shoes for Tomorrow, or TOMS, and sells them for about $40. For every pair he sells, he gives another to an impoverished child.
If I started a charity, I would have to go raise money every time I wanted to give them shoes. But if I started a business and made a shoe where the consumer liked it for what it was, then the consumer will be my natural provider of the shoes every year.
McCoskey sold more than 8,000 pairs the first year. He expects to sell 80,000 this year and 175,000 pairs in 2008. Courtney Rotolo buys shoes for American Rag, a boutique in Los Angeles. She says TOMS is the only shoe she buys that involves charity.
It appealed to me before I even knew that there was a cause behind it, just because it's an easy sell in Southern California.
Thanks to stores like American Rag, TOMS gave away more than 8,000 pairs in Argentina last year. This fall, McCoskey and 50 volunteers will put TOMS on the feet of 50,000 kids in South Africa.
When you have TOMSitis, every time you see a child, you want to give them a pair of shoes.
Filmmaker Kenneth Cokin documented the first shoe giveaway. His film, Capitalist Revolution, shows Argentine kids playing soccer in their new shoes. They use fallen trees for goalposts and wrapped-up garbage bags for a ball. Cokin says McCoskey hasn't spent a dime on advertising.
You know, I told people I made a documentary for TOMS, and they're like, oh, I have a pair of those. I'm like, well, you got a pair? Oh, yeah, it was in Vogue, and I bought it online.
TOMS may be a charitable enterprise, but it's no not-for-profit. McCoskey knows he has to stay focused on the basics of the business if he wants the charity to survive.
Getting better at making shoes, shipping on time, all the things that make it a business.
There'll be time for play, too. At the parties this weekend, TOMS will hand out white canvas shoes and paint to decorate them with. McCoskey could walk away with a few original designs. For free, of course. In Los Angeles, I'm Brett Bruhn for Marketplace.
The United States isn't the only country trying to figure out how to cope with tricky immigration issues. German officials are considering easing up on requirements for work visas. Businesses there have been pushing hard for it as a way to plug holes in their labor market. And here's another case in point. For the past year, the European Union has been spending $5,000 an hour for air and sea patrols off the African coast. They're trying to stop illegal immigrants heading north. The EU's also spending money trying to persuade people to just stay home. John Larson reports now from one popular point of departure for many illegal migrants in Morocco.
A train full of rock rumbles through from the mines on its way to the port at Casablanca. But Hulibga, Phosphate City, is also a centre of illegal migration, that desperate lunge for a better life that they call, in Arabic, the Khalig. In the dusty streets, the kids play skipping games. Their elder brothers, even those with jobs, dream of escape. Ahmed is 21 years old.
I'd like to leave, but I can't afford it. I'm a mason. I earn $40 a week, which is what I need to live on. To get to Europe, you need $1,300 for the frontier runners. My father's dead. There's only my mother left and my little brothers. They need me to emigrate. It's the only way they can get a better life.
Ahmed shrugs when I ask him about the dangers, but 5,000 people have drowned these past 8 years trying to cross the sea to Europe. Fatima Zahra is 22, but she already looks old.
I'm from a village outside of Horubka. One day, a people smuggler came offering to take people to Italy in an inflatable boat. We found the money. We paid him $4,000. But the boat sank. My husband and 54 others drowned.
Hulibga Migration Radio set up last year to try to stop these casualties, part of a $2 million joint EU-Italian aid program that also helps illegals who've been sent home. With its broadcasts on the internet, Migration Radio set out to break a taboo and talk about the dangers and disappointments of illegal migration.
Bonjour, dans votre cinquième émission Radio Hulibga Migration et joyeux Ramadan. Avec vous, Paco.
Il est là.
Paco, one of the presenters, got his Spanish nickname from his first trip to Europe. It was the name of the Coast Guard who fished him out of the Straits of Gibraltar. His boat had sunk. He was drowning. The Spaniard saved his life, then sent him home. Back in Morocco, the former street vendor joined the Association of Families of the Victims of Illegal Immigration, AFVIC by its French acronym, and became an inspiration for young people in Hulibga and beyond. But now, Paco has gone. Leila El Makas, his co-presenter, says she still can't believe it. Paco went to Europe on a tourist visa. It expired weeks ago, and he's still not come home. The star of the struggle against the Kharig has done what he spent the past years telling other Moroccans not to do, migrate illegally to Europe. For AFVIC's president, Khalil Jemaa, Paco's departure is the last straw.
Nous avons échoué.
We failed, he says. There's just too much stacked against us. Pick tomatoes all day in Morocco and you get $4. In Spain, you get 40. And he says it's not just the wage gap that's driving migrants out of Africa, but corruption, nepotism and lack of democracy. Even the songs encourage people to emigrate, like this one called Leave for Far Away. The trouble is, says Khalil Jemaa, the people best qualified to build a better country are the first to go. That's why he's got to keep fighting the Kharig, but differently this time. In September, he's launching a new section of AFVIC called Morocco Watch, $120,000 of EU backing, a human rights and corruption watchdog. Instead of just trying to persuade people to stay, they're going to pressure the people in charge in Morocco to make this country worth staying in. In Hulibga, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, we mentioned yesterday iPhone sales had been somewhat disappointing for AT&T and that had hurt Ma Bell's profits. In fact, what was disappointing were iPhone activations with the phone carrier. We didn't get sales numbers for the gadgets themselves until Apple reported quarterly profits today, 270,000 of them in the last 2 days of the quarter. Macs, the computers, were good for CEO Steve Jobs, too, and all profits almost doubled to $818 million. Back to the iPhone for just a second. Jobs says he hopes to sell a cool million of them by the end of this quarter. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 68 points, half of 1%. The Nasdaq stepped up 8 points, a third of a percent. The S&P 500 jumped 7 points. That's a quarter percent there. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Phil Richards, Joel Stein, and Tim Bomba are our engineers. Next time, the ABCs of high teacher turnover.
Endless interruptions in their classroom, unnecessary paperwork, meetings that had no purpose. Teachers really were saying that they didn't have time to teach.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.